air-conditioned, soundproofed rear seat of his big limousine, driving was still as pleasurable as it had always been. Robert Moses, who had never had to drive in a single traffic jam, really believed that his transportation policies would work. "Traffic will run pretty smoothly within 3 years," he had said in 1945. During those 3 years, and afterward, he repeated that prediction often, repeated it without hedging or qualification, spread it on the public record with the assurance of a man sure that he was right. He was confident that his roads would earn him applause now, as they had always earned him applause before. Writing on traffic relief in a New York Times Magazine article, he said, "If we give this to our people, we shall deserve their gratitude." Applause not just of the age, but of the ages. He was confident that his roads would bring him immortality. He had read Statius. He knew that, in gratitude for the benefits bestowed upon them by the construction of the Domitian Way, the Senate and the people of Rome had raised a triumphal arch to Domitian. He knew that the Via Appia had brought immortality to its builder, the blind censor Appius Claudius, who, when public funds to build the road ran out, had advanced the difference from his private fortune. Democracies raised no triumphal arches to road builders. The Wantagh Causeway was still named the Wantagh Causeway, despite the fact that its builder had also advanced funds from his private fortune, or at least from his mother's. But he was confident history would remedy such oversights. In 1949, Times Sunday editor Lester Markell commissioned him to forecast the city in the year 1999. "The great arteries will stand out," he wrote. On another occasion, he wrote, "Those who aim and plug away at limited, nearby objectives and reach them may in fact build better than they know. Their works may even last longer than those fashioned by more ambitious geniuses for immortality." If he was capable any longer of rethinking his policies, he gave no evidence of it. And because of his power, of course, there was nothing that could force him to rethink. Within weeks of the opening of the Van Wyck Expressway, at which Moses proudly boasted that "no network of major urban vehicular arteries comparable to the one on which we are busily working here in New York City will be found anywhere else on this or any other continent," the road was as jammed as F. Dodd McHugh had predicted. At rush hours, when, as McHugh had predicted, 10,000 travelers trying to get to Idlewild were forced to share the road space with tens of thousands of commuters trying to get home, the 4 miles of roadway which Moses had hacked across Queens looked like a 4-mile-long parking lot, so closely were the vehicles on it packed together and so slowly were they moving. "Traffic will flow freely," Moses had promised. Inappropriate adverb. Drivers were chained to the Van Wyck. Men who, commuting daily to jobs at the airport or in New York, had taken 20 minutes to cover the 4 miles paralleling the Van Wyck, had looked forward to the opening of the publicized new road. Now, clocking their first trips on it, they could hardly believe their watches. Where it had taken 20 minutes to cover the 4 miles on local streets, it took 30 minutes on the expressway, if conditions were good. And so often, they were bad. The new road had not freed them from the trap of daily travel. It had closed the trap on them more firmly than ever, for new traffic, generated by the new road, was also jamming the local streets. With every passing year, congestion on the expressway worsened. McHugh had calculated that during peak periods, 10,000 persons would be trying to reach Idlewild every hour. As air traffic burgeoned, that figure became 15,000 and then 20,000. New parking fields were built within the airport at a frantic rate. 500 acres of marshland were paved over, then 1,000, then 2,000, then 4,000, then 8,000. And still there was never enough room to park. At peak periods, the paved space within Idlewild, parking fields and internal roadways, was often so jammed that the torrent of vehicles oozing down the Van Wyck could enter the airport only at a trickle. Sometimes the airport had to be closed to new traffic. It was not infrequent for vehicles waiting to get into Idlewild to be backed up on the expressway for a solid mile. Inside the airport, of course, the scene was chaos. Drivers searching for parking spaces milled around and around on the roadways, mingling with drivers trying to get to the airline terminals. By one estimate, at a normal weekday rush hour, a traveler arriving at Idlewild by private car had to allow a full 30 minutes for travel after arriving at the airport. Other roads were jammed and created by their opening more traffic than had existed before. The Brooklyn Battery Tunnel opened on May 25, 1950, with blessings from Cardinal Spellman, one of man's greatest achievements, what may have been the longest cavalcade of official limousines ever assembled outside Washington, 338 long black Cadillacs, the highest toll ever charged on a Moses project, 35 cents, and a traffic count almost twice as high as Madigan Highland had predicted. Moses engineers had forecast that the tunnel would carry 8,400,000 cars during its first year of operation. By the end of a month, it was carrying traffic at a 13 million vehicle per year rate, 64% above their predictions. George Spargo explained that the count had been swelled by an influx of tourists who had come from all over the eastern seaboard to see this new wonder of the world, and that the influx was over now. By the end of 3 months, the tunnel was carrying traffic at a 14 million vehicle per year rate. At the end of 6 months, it was carrying traffic at a 15 million vehicle per year rate. And not only the increase, but the rate of increase was increasing every month. Another pleasant surprise, Spargo said. But the tunnel was engineered for a capacity rush hour load of 2,000 vehicles. By 1952, it was being asked during rush hour to handle 5,000, even 6,000 vehicles per hour. Traffic backed up for blocks at its entrances. Moses had expected it to draw off traffic from the parallel Queens Midtown Tunnel and three free East River bridges. But traffic on the bridges remained normal, which meant jammed, and traffic through the Queens Midtown Tunnel, fed now by the widened Queens Midtown Expressway, increased instead of decreasing. In 1951, while the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel was carrying cars at a rate of 79.3% above estimates, traffic through the Queens Midtown Tunnel was 26.3% higher than ever before. Previously, 10,967,000 cars per year had been trying to use one tunnel. Now there were two tunnels, and 28,445,668 cars were trying to use them. The situation at the southern portion of the East River was duplicated at the northern. In Triborough's annual report for 1951, Spargo wrote happily, "The Triborough Bridge had its 15th birthday on July 11th. There were no birthday cakes, presents, or ceremonies, just more automobiles." In 1946, the first post-war year, the bridge had carried 13 million vehicles. In 1947, it had carried 16 million vehicles. In 1948, 19 million. In 1949, 23 million. In 1950, 27 million. The count in 1951 had been 32 million. And the trend was more striking than the figures. The increase had been 2 million in 1946, 3 million in 1947 and 1948, 4 million in 1949 and 1950, 5 million in 1951. And this situation was being duplicated on the Bronx Whitestone Bridge, which Moses had built to drain off traffic from the Triborough. While traffic was increasing 138% on the Triborough between 1946 and 1951, it was increasing 129% on the Bronx Whitestone. And traffic volume on the free Queensborough Bridge was also increasing. In the last pre-war year, cars had been crossing the East River into Manhattan at the colossal rate of 122,500 per day. In 1951, they were pouring across the river into Manhattan at the rate of 135,000 per day. And what of the roads leading to and from these facilities? Four lanes of Belt Parkway had been jammed before the war. Now, six lanes of Belt Parkway were jammed. Pre-war congestion on Old Atlantic Avenue had been intolerable. Post-war congestion on a new, widened, modernized Atlantic Avenue was more intolerable. And it wasn't only bridges and highways that were jammed. as seen from the air at rush hours, every street in neighborhoods near the approaches to the East River crossings was a crawling mass of cars. On the other side of Manhattan, where, since 1930, the Port Authority's George Washington Bridge and Holland and Lincoln tunnels had been open to vehicular traffic while New Jersey railroads had been allowed to deteriorate, the situation was being duplicated. Since 1930, railroad commutation from Jersey had declined slightly. Commutation by motor vehicle had quadrupled. In the evenings, when 80,000 daily commuters were heading home to Jersey, all of Manhattan between 175th and 181st Street was solid with cars, trucks, and buses moving toward the George Washington Bridge. Downtown, the typical line of cars waiting to enter the Holland Tunnel Plaza was, at 5 p.m., 8 blocks long. The Times, clocking travel time to the Lincoln Tunnel, found on one evening that it took a truck 27 minutes to make a one-block square circuit to the entrance plaza. Within the city, it seemed that there was not a crevice into which cars did not cram. Traffic was piling up everywhere. On the crosstown side streets in Midtown Manhattan, the Times found, motorists frequently spent 40 minutes traversing the 2.5 miles from one side of the island to the other. The clockings themselves were of less significance than the fact that the Times was making them. We learn to tolerate intolerable conditions. Press and public reaction to motor traffic congestion in New York City documents the truth of Barbara Ward's statement. It was during the early 1920s that such traffic first overwhelmed New York. In 1924 and 1925 and 1926, the public reacted with indignation and protest against the jams in which, seated in the vehicles that had promised them new freedom, they found themselves imprisoned instead. Traffic was news, big news. Clockings were a front-page staple. By the late 1920s, however, a kind of numbness, measurable by a slackening in angry letters to the editor and campaign statements by both ears to the ground politicians, was setting in. Psychologists know what happens to rats motivated by mild electric shocks or the promise of a food reward to get out of a maze when the maze is made excessively difficult to get out of. For a while, their efforts to find an escape become more and more frantic, and then they cease, the creatures becoming sullen, then listless, suffering apathetically through shock or hunger, rather than making further efforts that they believe will be useless. People caught in intolerable traffic jams twice a day, day after day, week after week, month after month, began after some months to accept traffic jams as part of their lives, to become hardened to them, to suffer through them in dull and listless apathy. The press, responding to its readers' attitude, ran fewer hysterical congestion stories, gave fewer clockings. A city editor, seeing a couple of reporters with their feet up on their desks on a slow Friday afternoon, found other make-work than sending them out to discover how long it took to get from the Queens Midtown Tunnel to the Lincoln Tunnel. Only in editorial columns, written, it sometimes seems, by men selected through a Darwinian process in which the vital element for survival is an instant and constant capacity for indignation and urgency, did the indignation and urgency endure. Traffic was still news, but it was no longer big news. The same process was repeated during the middle and late 1930s, not because a new wound had been inflicted, but because the scab on the old one had been ripped off. Moe's unprecedentedly ambitious traffic devices, together with his highly publicized promises that they would solve the traffic problem, and the easing in that problem that occurred for a few months every time a new facility was opened, raised hopes. With hope, motorists dared to look again at what they were being subjected to. And when, a few months after each new facility opened, the jams began to build up again, their consciousness, newly reopened, was rubbed all the more raw. In the last 2 or 3 years of that decade, with the Triborough Bridge and the West Side Highway and the Interborough and Grand Central Parkways open and congestion worse than ever, there was another howl of public anguish. In contrast to the 20s, however, in the 30s, the anguish was beginning to be coupled with awareness. As new bridges jammed up without easing the jams on the old, as every lane of gleaming white concrete was filled with cars as soon as it was open to traffic, Lewis Mumford and the Regional Plan Association were no longer lone voices crying that no number of bridges and highways could alone solve the traffic problem. Before World War II, the numbness set in again. The howls died down. Motorists sank back into apathy. But before they did, letters to the editor, speeches and articles by urban planners, and resolutions of civic associations revealed a greatly increased understanding that something more, something different, was needed. The war kept people off the roads. It made them forget the pain. And when, after gasoline and rubber rationing ended, New Yorkers took to the highways again, the numbness had worn off. When the pain returned, it seemed sharper than ever. Even in late 1945 and early 1946, when it was no worse than it had been in 1941, people were complaining, and editorial writers calling for action far louder than they had in 1941. After a short while, they had, in fact, more to complain about. The pain didn't only seem worse, it was worse. Post-war traffic congestion was congestion escalated to an entirely new level. The problem was so immense now that it was difficult even to comprehend its dimensions. How come to grips in one's imagination with a situation in which a mighty expressway, a gigantic superhighway of dimensions literally almost unknown to history, could be opened one month and be filled to absolute capacity the next, in which expressways opened in 1952 were by 1955 carrying the traffic load that had been forecast for 1985, in which, in this city and metropolitan area already congested to the breaking point, every indicator of traffic, auto registrations, commuting trips per day, was increasing in more than arithmetical, in almost geometrical, progression. The press did not in general come to grips with it, at least not in its deeper implications, but it did report thoroughly on its more superficial and more dramatic manifestations. Traffic was news again. The Times, which had once sent its reporters over the West Side Highway so that it could tell its readers how incredibly fast it made travel, now sent its reporters onto it to report that, at a peak period of evening travel, northbound vehicles took 34 minutes to cover 4.5 miles. Editorials argued in the Times and Tribune and screamed in the News and Mirror for action, now. As for the individuals caught in this colossal traffic trap twice a day, any psychologist knows that if he turns up the voltage of the electric shock enough, the rats will be shocked out of their apathy and begin frantically scurrying back and forth through the maze again, searching desperately for a way out. Newspaper stories of this period document an almost frantic search by drivers for a way out of their trap. Grim U-turns in the face of oncoming traffic to avoid huge jams seen ahead. Reporting on one at the Third Avenue Bridge on a hot summer Sunday, in which hundreds of cars were backed up over a 2-mile radius, the Times reported that the snarls were intensified as motorists tried to make U-turns to get out of the jam. Frantic lane switching that drove up accident rates on all major routes. Attempts to find new ways through the maze. Reported the New Yorker, never one of Moses' favorite publications anyway, "We've become increasingly aware that the best way to avoid highway congestion is to duck the proud network of parkways in Westchester and Long Island and take to the traffic-lighted, non-cloverleaf-intersected roads of our youth. What have man and Moses wrought? Answer, a boomerang." With the numbness not yet having had a chance to set in again, and the pain, still fresh, more intense than ever, there was an upsurge in the question of how best to alleviate it. Awareness was escalating, too. Now there was general awareness among urban planners and some segments of the public that something else might be just as important as roads, might in fact be more important. By 1952, there was in at least 3 New York newspapers, the Times, the Tribune, and the Post, at least the beginning of emphasis on the need to improve and add mass transit facilities as well as roads. There was even a beginning of the realization that the construction of highways alone might be boomeranging, defeating its own ends, a realization Lewis Mumford was later to summarize in a 1955 series of articles in The New Yorker, The Roaring Traffic's Boom. The prevalent conception is that the main purpose of traffic is to enable a maximum number of citizens to derive all possible benefits from the use of automobiles, Mumford said. But that isn't the purpose of transportation at all. Transportation, I blush to utter a truism now so frequently ignored, is a means and not an end. Like any other tool, it must be used for some human purpose beyond the employment of the tool itself. He said that, before we cut any more chunks out of our parks to make room for more automobiles or let another highway cloverleaf unfold, we should look at the transformation that has taken place during the last 30 years in Manhattan. Ever since the 1920s, the municipal and state authorities have been plunging blindly from one grandiose traffic scheme to another, without showing any striking understanding of the problems they were trying to solve. For a whole generation, New York has become steadily more frustrating and tedious to move around in, more expensive to do business in, more unsatisfactory to raise children in, and more difficult to escape from for a holiday in the country. The subway rides grow longer, and the commuting trains carry their passengers from more distant suburbs until as much time is spent in transporting the human carcass as is gained by diminishing the work week. The distant dormitory areas of New York describe ever-wider arcs. By 1975, it will be impossible to build enough highways to accommodate the weekend exodus, just as it is already impossible to provide enough internal traffic arteries to handle Manhattan's present congestion. But your one-eyed specialists continue to conduct grandiose plans for highway development, as if motor transportation existed in a social vacuum, and as if New York were a mere passageway or terminal for vehicles, with no good reasons of its own for existence. To these experts, a successful solution of the traffic problem consists of building more roads, bridges, and tunnels so that more motor cars may travel more quickly to more remote destinations in more chaotic communities, from which more roads will be built so that more motorists may escape from these newly soiled and clotted environments. Instead of curing congestion, they widen chaos. The private motor car is a method that happens to be, on the basis of the number of people it transports, by far the most wasteful of urban space. Because we have apparently decided that the private motor car has a sacred right to go anywhere, halt anywhere, and remain anywhere as long as its owner chooses, we have neglected other means of transportation. The major corrective for this crippling overspecialization is to redevelop now despised modes of circulation, public vehicles and private feet. An effective modern city plan would use each kind in its proper place and to its proper extent. Mr. Robert Moses uses the word regional planning as a swear word to indicate his abiding hatred of comprehensive and forward-looking policies, just as he invokes the term long-haired planner to designate anyone who turns up with a proposal that does not fit into his own set of assumptions, most of them by now manifestly inadequate and badly out of date. Think. A handful of thinkers like Mumford were even beginning to venture a revolutionary opinion that automobiles and highways should be barred from certain central areas of the city, that some congested avenues and streets should, instead of having their roadways widened for cars, be closed to cars and turned into pedestrian malls. Some, in fact, were beginning to postulate a more revolutionary opinion still, that major arterial through highways had no place in the interior of a city at all, that a city could not endure as a good place to live if they were built in any number within its borders. This awareness was by no means pervasive. If the Times, the Tribune, and the Post were beginning to emphasize the importance of mass transit vis-a-vis highways, little of the same emphasis could be found in the city's other daily newspapers. For several of these, in fact, a frequent practice when the need for a transportation analysis was felt was to ask Moses to write it, his articles appearing in the News and Journal American, for example. The Journal American was, of course, part of the Hearst chain, and in 1952, Hearst newspapers were conducting a nationwide campaign for new and better roads. But the awareness was spreading. After July 1951, when the Regional Plan Association published the results of investigations to determine the amount, extent, and trends of commuting to central New York, facts and figures were available to document the effect of two decades of neglecting mass transit facilities in favor of highways. A few months earlier, Moses, issuing a lavish four-color brochure, had boasted that, in our reports in Milestones of Progress, issued on important occasions, when something has happened which is worth telling about, we rely on illustration rather than technical explanations, which are bound to be dull, statistical, and boring. The RPA's Bulletin No. 77, black and white, was statistic-crammed, but to anyone interested in why New York's congestion was really increasing so rapidly, it was not boring, but startling. The common assumption, previously held not only by Moses, but by press, politicians, and many urban planners, was that congestion was increasing because the population around New York was increasing at a tremendous rate, and therefore commuting into New York must be increasing at a tremendous rate. Estimates of the number of commuters had ranged from 500,000 to 1,500,000. The fact, a fact documented for the first time in Bulletin 77, was that although the population was increasing just as fast as people thought it was, the number of families in the counties surrounding New York had increased by 50% between 1930 and 1950, the commuting wasn't. There had been 301,000 commuters coming into the city daily in 1930. In 1950, there were 357,000, an increase of only 19%. The difference was not in the number of people coming into and out of New York every day, but in how they were coming. The number of rail commuters had actually declined, from 263,000 in 1930 to 239,000 in 1950. 38,050 persons had commuted by automobile in 1930. 118,400 persons commuted by automobile in 1950. While the number of commuters was up 19%, the number of automobile commuters was up 321%. And, the RPA articles showed, the trend was continuing and accelerating. The gap between use of rail and road was widening month by month. The failure to maintain existing railroad lines in a condition that would persuade even their present riders to keep using them, much less to attract new ones, the failure to construct new lines into newly developed areas while building new highways into those areas, was driving more and more commuters off the railroad and onto the highway. The effect on the city of the widening gap could only be disastrous. The automobiles required to transport the equivalent of one trainload of commuters use about 4 acres of parking space in Manhattan, 8 times the area of the Grand Central Main Concourse. Every trainload of commuters shifting to automobiles requires automobile parking space about equal to the effective parking capacity of one side of Fifth Avenue from Washington Square to 68th Street, 3 miles. The lesson to be gleaned from the statistics was clear, even though they did not include statistics on the intra-city shift in subway to automobile use, statistics that would have made the lesson even more dramatic. The trend must be reversed. Emphasis must be shifted from road building to railroad building. The lesson was scanted by most of the press. The RPA report received one-day play in most of New York's papers. But in 1954, it was repeated in more popular form by a Time series, and thereafter there was at least a general awareness of it in most of the more detailed transportation stories in the New York press. And, as in the previous decade, it sometimes seemed, from the sharp tone of letters to the editor compared to editorials, that awareness was growing faster among the public than in the media supposed to educate the public or among the politicians supposed to lead the public. Almost as if the people of New York and its suburbs, forced to spend hours daily being exposed to the harsh lessons of urban transportation, trapped daily in a classroom on the realities of urban transportation, a classroom in which the reality of what was being taught was worsening so fast that numbness had not yet caught up to it, were learning the lessons for themselves. Mumford was not the only person pleading with public officials to think. Many men and women who had never opened a planning textbook in their lives were, by the early 1950s, repeating in their own words the great planner's plea. People were learning for themselves. By 1940, most urban planners had come to understand that roads were not good per se, that a highway was not an unqualified boon for mankind. By the early 1950s, much of the general public appeared to understand this too, even if the press did not. There was general awareness of the need for a dramatic change in the region's transportation policies. Mumford, unsatisfied though he was at the rate of mobilization of public opinion, the majority of the American people remained strangely quiet and passive about the matters that should concern them most, saw hope now that Moses' irrational plans could be changed, pointing out that the things that spoil life in New York and its environs were all made by men and can be changed by men as soon as they are willing to change their minds. He now saw hope that men would do so. But for New York, only one mind mattered, and that mind would not change. As Moses' first post-war mileage had been opening, he had been as confident of the wisdom of his policies as he had been when he announced them in 1945. "Today, we are well underway to a solution of the traffic problem," he had boasted in 1948. Now, in 1954, with considerable new mileage open, the problems were worse than ever, but the confidence was diminished not a whit. All that was necessary, he said, and believed, was more of the same. The roads he had been building had all been conceived by him in 1930. Now, for the first time, he expanded his highway plan. "New arterials should be built paralleling old arterials already built," he announced. "A Sheridan paralleling the Major Deegan and Bronx River and Harlem River and Hutchinson River and Henry Hudson that already ran down through the Bronx. A Nassau paralleling the Van Wyck southeast through Queens. Arterials should be built into sections of the city into which no arterials now ran. A Prospect and Cross Brooklyn Expressway into the teeming heart of that borough, for example. And arterials should reach out from the city into its suburbs, a Long Island Expressway all the way out deep into still rural Suffolk, for example. And, of course, the series of east and west crossings in Manhattan, which he had so long advocated, should be begun." It was during this period that he was forcing the Port Authority to start the Lincoln Tunnel link that would give him a wedge on the mid-Manhattan crossing along 30th Street. As to what to do with the cars when they got to the city, he had no doubt that his proposed multi-story, off-street parking garages, 2, 3, 4 stories, or whatever height they have to be, would solve that problem. The success of the first publicly financed off-street garage in the city's history, Triborough's 7-story Battery Park garage, it was filled to capacity almost from the day it opened, proved that. "When we get the expressways, you will see how they will take care of most of this through or crosstown traffic," he said in a lengthy 1952 question-and-answer session with U.S. News and World Report, which identified him as the recognized authority on the future of American cities. Question: but in city streets, are off-street garages the answer? Answer: yes. As for the use of city money for mass transit construction, he fought such proposals to their death. And when, in 1952, some state legislators suggested that Triborough take over the city's subways and use its surplus to improve them, Moses rushed back from a Virgin Islands vacation to declare that there was no surplus because "all our future revenues are pledged to our bondholders," who, he said, would never permit the authority to become involved in deficit-producing operations. In that same year, the General Electric Company announced that its urban traffic division had costed out rapid transit on Auto Highway Center malls, and that if provision for tracks was made in the original highway design, their cost would be 1/10 of providing them later. Moses' reply: "The cost of acquiring additional width and building for rapid transit would be prohibitive, and hundreds of families would be dislocated." Not all planners fully understood yet that if Moses' proposals were carried out, New York would become a place not for people, but for cars, spread out by the hundreds of acres on monstrous parking fields, cars piled up 7 stories high or more, to whatever height they have to be, cars that would bring their roar and the fumes of their foul exhausts into its every corner. But they did understand fully. By 1952, there was a general understanding among urban planners, an informed consensus, that Moses' plans made no sense unless they were supplemented by mass transportation. There was some applause in the press for Moses' proposals. These were the years in which he was enjoying general editorial support for a proposal to create a city parking authority with unprecedented power over the city's streets, and a rather remarkable lack of understanding of some of the subtleties of transportation politics. A Herald Tribune editorial said that Triborough's 1951 annual report ought to give every citizen of New York a bit of a thrill. Business is booming. Traffic is everywhere exceeding the experts' predictions. If the present volume keeps up, all the bridge bonds will be retired by 1957 and all tunnel bonds by 1963. When that happens, every bridge and tunnel so successfully built and operated by the Triborough Authority will become the free and unencumbered property of the people of New York City. Good work, gentlemen. Only the Post gave more than scant attention to the problems of the thousands of tenants being evicted from Moses' highways. While press applause was by no means as enthusiastic as it would once have been, and editorials more and more frequently expressed doubt about the city's transportation policies, they never linked those policies with the man responsible for them. There was no direct attack on Moses, no threat of any real seriousness to his power. And with that power, he laid out the new routes, obtained the state and federal commitments for them, had the blueprints drawn, started them down the road to completion. And in 1954, he took a further step, one that sealed the city's future.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
The Power Broker. Robert Moses and the Fall of New York. By Robert Caro. Chapter 40. Point of No Return. The silver stream of quarters and dimes and nickels on which Moses' power was based was flowing faster and faster. By 1952, with 120 million vehicles per year using Triborough's facilities, the authority's annual revenues stood at $28,300,000, an increase of 453% over pre-war levels. And since operating and maintaining its bridges and tunnels cost little, and not even Moses could spend enough on parties, luncheons, brochures, ribbon cuttings, and advance planning to make a dent in such income, most of the revenue was surplus. After paying all bills and interest, the authority's surplus for 1953 alone was $21 million. Capitalized, multiplied in terms of the amount of revenue bonds that could be sold because of it, its total surplus was worth, at 1953 interest rates and bond market conditions, close to $500 million. The man who had once had to beg bankers to give him $3 million for the Henry Hudson Bridge, one deck at a time, now could obtain from bankers $500 million, and the bankers would fight for the chance to give it to him. Moses now had available to spend on public works in the city far more money than the city had available to spend. The very size of that surplus, however, made it a source of danger as well as opportunity. Were the attention of public and politicians to be focused upon it, they might demand that it be used, in the spirit of the law creating the authority, to retire its outstanding bonds and remove its tolls. The Herald Tribune editorial demonstrated how easily such a demand could spring up, especially if it was ever realized that all the bonds could be retired and toll booths torn down, not in some distant future, but within 6 years. or to ease the subway deficit and the need to raise subway fares. The alarming speed with which the legislators demand that Triborough bail out the subways had caught fire before Moses had rushed back from the Virgin Islands to stamp it out with the statement that there was no surplus was an indication of its appeal. Either course, bond retirement or subway bailout, would strip Moses of his accumulating millions. He had realized back in the 30s that authorities could be a means to immense achievement and a source of immense personal power, but only if their revenues were spent on new public works as fast as they were earned. Only if, in other words, he kept building as fast as possible. The editorials and resolutions of the 50s only demonstrated again the correctness of that insight. Triborough's money had to be spent, and it had to be spent fast. There was, however, a problem that could be solved only by rapprochement with his old foe, the Port Authority of New York. Vast as his resources might be, they were nowhere near as vast as his dreams. Ground was already broken for the Colosseum. He was going to have to pour $43 million into that gaping hole at Columbus Circle. The Throgs Neck Bridge must get underway as soon as possible. For that span, he would need $92 million. He had already allocated $90 million to get work underway on the Long Island and Prospect Expressways and the East River Drive extension up to the Triborough Bridge. Almost half the $500 million was already committed. Then there were the other roads, envisioned decades before and still unbuilt. Their cost was measured now in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And the bridge, which he had conceived of as the crowning glory of his career, the supreme monument to the life of Robert Moses, a bridge whose construction would take close to 5 years, was not yet even begun. And Moses was, after all, already 65 years old. Who knew when time, so long on his side, might turn on him with the Narrows Crossing not yet begun. And the Narrows Crossing would, without approaches, just for the bridge structure alone, cost $345 million. And how about the new parks he wanted to create, the old parks he wanted to reshape, Jamaica Bay, which was to be his park masterpiece, Jamaica Bay, which was to be his creation, not merely his reworking of an Olmsted creation, Jamaica Bay, which was to be the greatest urban waterfront park in the world, was not even begun. There was so much yet to do. Even the monumental wealth of Triborough was nowhere near enough to do it. Wealth far greater was almost within his grasp. The proposal, even then in preparation in Washington, for a federal interstate highway system, for which the federal government would pay 90% of the cost, a state only 10%, would make $50 billion available to construct 41,000 miles of such highways during the next 10 years. Moses had been working quietly with top Eisenhower aide Sherman Adams and with General Lucius D. Clay, chairman of a key presidential committee studying highway needs, on details of the program. The scope of it, in fact, was his. $50 billion over 10 years were his figures, and had succeeded in obtaining a key revision in the program. Although Eisenhower was adamant that the new highways were not to be toll roads, Moses had obtained the inclusion of a clause saying they could link up with toll facilities. If he could build the bridges, the federal government would pay for the highways connecting with them. But to be eligible for inclusion in the interstate system, highways had to be interstate. They had not only to connect with highways in another state, but to form with those highways a highway system interstate rather than local in character. Given the geographical location of New York City, that state could only be New Jersey, and in the portion of New Jersey closest to New York, the highway building power was the Port Authority. There were additional incentives for rapprochement. Since O'Dwyer had handed it Idlewild in 1946, every ensuing confrontation between the two giant public benefit corporations had resulted in a Moses victory. During the reign of Impey, in fact, he had forced the Port Authority to agree to reserve $13 million for his Mid-Manhattan Expressway as the price for permission to enlarge the Lincoln Tunnel. But the situation had changed. Wagner Jr., for a man who's been a friend of your father's, you have a sense of humility, of respect, had just become mayor, and the Port Authority's chairman had been one of his father's closest friends, K. campaign treasurer for his 1926 senatorial race, in fact. Howard S. Cullman was as adroit as Moses at playing on the mayor's feelings. Wagner, astute judge of men that he was fully aware of what Cullman was doing. "I always knew when he wanted something," the mayor would recall years later of his fellow Yale graduate. "He'd take me to lunch at the Players Club, and he'd talk about the 26th campaign and about Yale." But Wagner let him do it anyway. Nothing, not even an awareness of how men used it to play on him, could lessen the respect. And Wagner was not a man in any case to offend or even confront a Port Authority board that included, besides tobacco tycoon Cullman and tugboat tycoon Eugene F. Moran, banking barons S. Sloan Colt of Bankers Trust and Bayard F. Pope of Marine Midland Trust. For Austin Tobin, Wagner had little use. The mayor's keen eye saw through his attempt to act as arrogant as Moses. Moses and Tobin? Oh, Moses is tougher and smarter. Once you get away from standing at the bridge and taking in quarters, what Tobin has is that board. When I first came in, Austin used to go around calling me stupid. Then I ran into him at a party, and I said, with a smile, "Austin, you want to get anything through, you better stop calling me stupid." He never called me stupid again, and Howard apologized to me for his behavior. But the board, coupled with the respect, was enough. Cullman's hold over the mayor was quickly apparent to City Hall insiders and to Moses. Without the mayor in his corner, the Port Authority was too big and too powerful to fight. Fighting such a foe could be not only bloody, but unprofitable. Cooperation might be profitable. With Port Authority help, he would be able to get there first for the federal cash in the 1950s as he had in the 1930s. Immediately upon passage of the Interstate Highway Act, he would be able to present to Washington a proposal for a complete, unified system of highways joining, across authority bridges and tunnels, New York and New Jersey, and, through New Jersey, linking up with other highways in other states. A proposal ready to go, planned, blueprinted, costed out, approved, ready for groundbreaking, while the proposals of other cities were still in the talking stage, years away from even a possibility of implementation. Cooperation might, moreover, allow him to tap not only the federal, but the Port Authority cash box. That cash box, so long empty, was full now, thanks to the post-war traffic boom, fuller even than Triborough's. Its 1953 surplus, its real surplus, not the one reported to the public, was $29 million. Triborough's surplus was worth $500 million in new bonds. The Port Authority's was worth $700 million. Long on cash, moreover, the Port Authority was short on dreams. The visionaries who had created it were long gone from its councils. Julius Henry Cohen had been replaced by money men like Cullman and Colt and Pope, whose eyes were brightened by the balances in the authority's ledgers, not by the potentialities for improving the common weal that those balances represented. The purpose for which the authority had been created, the development of an overall transportation system to knit together a great port, had been lost sight of for years. Plans the authority had aplenty, of course, but unrelated plans, plans for individual projects, joined by no link other than the fact that their construction would return the agency profit. It had more money than Moses, but no more than a fraction of his creative vision. As Wagner put it, "Once you get away from taking in quarters, what Tobin has is that board." And the board's first concern was that Tobin take in more quarters each year than the year before. What Moses had after the quarters was dreams. Moses may have seen, his actions suggest he saw, an opportunity to put the Port Authority surpluses at the service of those dreams, to persuade his erstwhile rival to build first those of its planned projects that would help to realize his vision. The stakes were too high, the chance for profit in both accomplishment and power too big, not to cooperate with his old enemy. Sometime in late 1953 or early 1954, over luncheon at Randall's Island, he broached to the Port Authority Board a plan of staggering scope. At succeeding luncheons at which Tobin represented the board, all did not go smoothly. The plan was Moses' plan. What he was proposing they build would turn out to be the bypass route around New York, which he had conceived in 1930, and which he had been building in bits and pieces ever since. And he lost no opportunity to make clear that it was his plan, and that anyone who questioned any of its details didn't know what he was talking about. At one luncheon, Tobin jumped up from the table, said, "I don't have to sit here and be insulted like this," and stalked out. But as it turned out, Tobin did have to sit still and be insulted. His boss, Cullman, persuaded by a super helping of Moses' charm that they were again the close friends they had been in the Al Smith era, ordered him to. For if Moses had reasons to be anxious to cooperate, so did the Port Authority's businessman board. Having plumbed, in a 10-year series of disputes, the depths of Moses' power in Albany, the Port Authority knew that, deep though theirs ran, his ran deeper. Having attempted to get a string on Hewlin Jack, the puppet borough president of Manhattan, the key borough in their plans, they had learned that all the strings were firmly in Moses' hands. Wherever they wanted to go in Manhattan, moreover, they found running along its shore, like a barricade in their path, the Henry Hudson Parkway, over which, as park commissioner, Moses had absolute control. They wanted to build a new bridge across the Hudson at 125th Street. Such a bridge required connections with the parkway, and, for maximum effectiveness, with Moses' proposed Upper Manhattan Expressway across 125th Street, and, via that expressway, with Moses' Triborough Bridge on the other side of Harlem. They wanted to double-deck the George Washington Bridge. Double-decking required new connections to the parkway. Moreover, with bridge traffic already cramming the streets of Upper Manhattan near the bridge, the 75% increase double-decking would generate could be handled only by construction of a trans-Manhattan expressway to the Bronx, with, at its far end, a bridge link to the Cross Bronx, and with links to the major Deegan and Harlem River expressways running along the banks of the river far below. City and state had given Moses a veto power over all such bridges and expressways. A power struggle would be bloody. Asked years later who would have won, Wagner would tell the author with a slow smile, "It would have been a hell of a struggle with that board." And what businessman wants blood when he can have profit? What businessman wants blood when he can end loss? Three Port Authority bridges, the Gothels, Bayonne, and Outer Bridge spans connecting Staten Island and New Jersey, had been losing money every year for 20 years, earning, in 1953 alone, $500,000 less than the interest on the bonds that had been floated to build them. Only the construction of the Narrows Crossing that would connect Staten Island to the rest of the city and open it up to large-scale traffic would turn those money losers into money makers. And Moses, thanks to his takeover of the Tunnel Authority, held sole legislative authorization to build the crossing. Triborough surpluses were, moreover, not the only surpluses being eyed by politicians. The pressure on the Port Authority to aid mass transit was, in fact, even greater than the pressure on Moses, because the five near-bankrupt railroads whose lines ended at the Hudson were pleading for rail connections across the river, and because the Port Authority's refusal to spend money on such connections was weakened by its original legislative mandate, which clearly envisioned it doing so. The New Jersey legislature was, in fact, even then in the process of establishing a Metropolitan Rapid Transit Commission, with a prestigious board of its own, and the legislature had pointedly given the MRTC the responsibility of producing an overall coordinated plan for transportation. The Port Authority had to get its surpluses committed, and it had to get them committed fast. Doing so was difficult on the basis of individual projects. A far-reaching road and bridge program would obviously be easier. Lastly, the Port Authority saw, as Moses saw, that, in the broadest view, they had an identity of interest. In the terms used by Dunn and Bradstreet, the terms in which the Port Authority Board and Austin Tobin thought, the success of toll facilities is largely dependent upon the adequacy and convenience of the approaches and connecting highways. Thus, like the ever-widening ripples from a stone dropped in the water, every improvement in this system of highways, even at some distance from the facilities, is likely to increase, to some extent, the traffic on those facilities. A huge new metropolitan region highway network would increase traffic on all bridges and tunnels, theirs as well as Moses. And such a network could be obtained most easily by, probably given the immensity of its cost, only by making it part of the interstate highway system, and it could most easily, perhaps only, become part of that system through cooperation. In February 1954, the Port Authority agreed to work with Triborough on a joint study of arterial facilities. And on January 16, 1955, the results, 62 pages long, hard-bound, four-color, glossy paper, summed up by Moses, who wrote its introduction and whose name, not by coincidence, was listed first among its sponsors, was released to the press. The joint study announced that the two authorities recommend and are prepared to proceed immediately with three bridge projects, building the Throgs Neck in Verrazano and double-decking the George Washington. It laid out a system of new arterial highways extending to and from these bridges, a Bergen County Expressway on the New Jersey side of the George Washington Bridge, and a depressed Trans-Manhattan Expressway, really a westward extension of the Cross Bronx Expressway on the New York side, a Clearview Expressway on the south or Queens side of the Throgs Neck Bridge, and a Throgs Neck Expressway and Cross Bronx Expressway eastern extension on the north or Bronx side, a Clove Lakes Expressway on the Staten Island side of the Narrows Bridge to link it up with the Goethals and Bayonne spans, and a 7th Avenue Expressway, really an extension of the Gowanus Parkway, which was itself now incorporated into the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway on the Brooklyn side. It recommended that these roads be built immediately with federal and state funds, along with a long-discussed Mid-Manhattan Elevated Expressway, linking the Lincoln and Queens Midtown tunnels, and the long-discussed Lower Manhattan Expressway, linking the Holland Tunnel with the Williamsburg and Manhattan bridges. And it recommended, for future construction, a vast new system of expressways across every borough of the city and stretching out into the suburbs, some that Moses had advocated previously and some that he had only recently envisioned. In Queens, a Long Island, Ridgewood, Maspeth, and Nassau. In the Bronx, a Sheridan and Bruckner. In Brooklyn, a Bushwick, Prospect, and Cross Brooklyn. In Staten Island, a West Shore, Richmond, and Willowbrook. And finally, an Upper Manhattan Expressway that would cross the island in the vicinity of 125th Street to link the Triborough Bridge on the island's east shore with another bridge, a Hudson River Bridge, which would touch down at 125th Street on the island's west shore, consideration of which should be deferred until the George Washington Bridge, Narrows Bridge, and Throgs Neck Bridge projects have been completed and the traffic patterns at that time can be studied. The joint program was nothing more nor less than a business arrangement, with the businessman who could bring to the new partnership the most of the crucial material, power, getting the most out of it. The arrangements for the Narrows Bridge are one proof of this. Moses did not have the money to build the bridge that he envisioned as his supreme monument, but he had the power to build it. The Port Authority was as anxious as Moses to see the Narrows Bridge built, and the Port Authority had the money to build it, but it did not have the power. So, under the joint program, the Port Authority agreed to pay for the construction of the bridge, under a contract which said that although the Port Authority would pay for it, the authority would have nothing else to say about it. The Triborough Authority would lease the great span from the Port Authority, operate it, maintain it, and control it absolutely, and would have the right to buy it as soon as it had accumulated enough cash to do so. Moses would, in other words, be building the bridge with his erstwhile rival's money, which would leave him with the money to build another bridge, the Throgs Neck. To get the Narrows Bridge built, moreover, the Port Authority had to give up another bridge that it had been anxious to build. It had to allocate for the Narrows span the money it had been planning to spend on the 125th Street span and formally agree to defer that span indefinitely. The business basis for the joint program is demonstrated more forcefully still by the program as a whole. As a result of the construction of the Narrows Bridge, use of the Port Authority's three Staten Island spans increased 172%, an increase that in terms of tolls collected came in 1970 to about $5,500,000 per year. As a result of the double decking of the George Washington Bridge, use of that bridge increased 75%, an increase that in terms of tolls collected came in 1970